politicians, political parties, pressure groups and social reformers all claim to want change and offer prescriptions that they claim would at least ameliorate the situation, if not actually solve it. So the Tories, for example, claim that if workers work harder for less money, if we have more respect for law and order and authority, if market forces are allowed to operate unfettered, if investment is encouraged, then prosperity and social harmony will follow. Labour argue that if more money is spent on infrastructure, if public expenditure was used to create jobs, if the welfare state was shored up, then we'd achieve social justice. And the Alliance parties and Tory wets like Ted Heath, and now it seems Michael Heseltine, that champion of democracy, argue for caring capitalism, or capitalism with a human face, to be achieved by, wait for it, pay restraint, which they claim will bring down unemployment. And we have a whole range of pressure groups, from Shelter to CND, from Oxfam to Anti-Apartheid, from Greenpeace to the Child Poverty Action Group, who all want to do something about the one particular social ill that they're most concerned with, without facing up to the whole range of problems that we are collectively faced with. So all these different individuals, groups, political parties all want some change, but they all want to achieve that change within the overall framework of the present economic system. They want to move resources around a bit, to spend a bit more on health and housing and a bit less on defence, to give us less pay but more tax cuts. All these methods have been tried before and have failed. The problems continue, as I'm sure most of you here tonight are only too well aware. And the reason why these methods have failed and will continue to fail is that they are trying to deal with the symptoms of the problem, not the cause. For the real cause of that problem is the economic system itself, capitalism. And as long as capitalism continues, so will those problems. For the aim of the capitalist system is not to meet the needs of people, to provide them with food, housing, and so on, but to make profit. Goods and services are only produced if there's a market for them, if there are people with money to buy them. If you have no money, then you can't have the goods. If no profit can be made, then the goods will not be produced, however much they might be needed. But capitalism not only means that no matter how much people may need something, that they'll not get it so long as they have no money to pay for it. It also means that society is divided into two classes. On the one hand, there's the capitalist class, those who own and control the means of production and distribution and live off the profits that they obtain by selling the goods and services that we, the working class, produce. And the working class is the majority of us, who own nothing except our ability to work, who are dependent on the capitalist class for a job in order that we can earn the money that we need in order to buy back the things that we ourselves make. And it's this system that makes it inevitable that no matter what good intentions reformers or politicians have, workers' needs worldwide will continue to go unmet. Socialists want change too. We want a change that's far more radical than anything that's been tried before. We want to abolish the present economic system that causes all these problems and replace it with a totally new kind of society, socialism. That society will be a society in which production will not take place for profit, but to meet human needs. A society which will enable people to directly control their own lives without the need for leaders or government. A society that's democratically organised on a worldwide basis. And we aim to achieve that society through the conscious political efforts of the working class itself. Trade unions, too, have also often been at the forefront for demands for change. In the 19th century, they were instrumental in securing the vote for the working class. And more recently, they tried to put pressure on governments in order to get better welfare provisions. But this isn't their primary purpose. Trade unions have developed alongside capitalism. They arose from a recognition that within capitalist society, the boss is in a very powerful position, and that individual workers acting on their own behalf are very weak. For example, if one worker went to his or her boss to ask for a pay rise, then the chances of success are going to be very limited. The boss is likely to turn around and give that worker the sack and simply employ somebody else to do that job. But if workers organise themselves collectively, then they're much better placed to put pressure on employers to secure higher wages and better working conditions. And thereby they stop worker competing with worker for the jobs that are available. And in fact, since trade unions were legalised in 1824, they have had some success in improving pay and conditions for their members. It's certainly true that without trade unions, things would be far worse than they are already. But trade unions are necessarily limited in what they can hope to achieve, for they are a part of the capitalist system itself. If there were no wages system, if there were no classes, there would be no need for trade unions. So trade unions, although they're in the front line of the day-to-day class struggle in the workplace, they're forced to operate within the economic laws of capitalism. And to believe otherwise is not only politically naive, but it's also politically dangerous. For no matter how well organised, no matter how united workers are, it is still the case that faced with industrial action to achieve higher pay, employers will only pay them as little as they can get away with. They'll certainly never pay them wages that are high enough to significantly damage their own profits. And ultimately, of course, the final weapon is in the employer's hands. For if they feel that there is no profit to be made, they can close down their business and move their capital somewhere else. And given the international nature of the capitalist system, faced with high labour costs in one part of the world, they can even move their whole operation to a part of the world where labour power can be bought more cheaply. But trade unions are also limited because they face not only their employers in industrial disputes, also the government and the state, who consistently back up the capitalist class. The government passes laws which restrict the activities of trade unions, and the Labour Party has, like all the other parties, enacted such legislation. Laws which affect how strikes are called and conducted, how trade unions are organised, what they do with their funds. Laws have been passed in all these areas. Employers can also use the courts to enforce those laws and to inflict serious damage on trade unions through court injunctions, as we've seen fairly recently, and sequestration of unions' funds. And they can use the police to interfere with the conduct of a strike. And again, as we saw in the film, the massive use of police during the miners' strike and the arrest of thousands of miners who were subsequently convicted, fined, imprisoned, and in many cases ultimately lost their jobs anyway. But finally, if they're really determined to break a strike, then the capitalist class can even use the armed forces. And again, all governments, no matter what their political complexion, have resorted to such methods. The capitalist class also uses propaganda as a tool to discredit trade unionists. Their effective monopoly of the mass media means that they can depict workers who are engaged in industrial action as thugs, hooligans, criminals, in an attempt to divide the working class and deprive the unions of the much-needed support of the other workers. But in addition to all these limitations, perhaps the most important limitations are the ones that trade unions impose upon themselves. They compete with each other for members, so that there's often more than one trade union representing a workforce in any given industry. So, for example, in the current teachers' dispute, the fact that there's more than one union involved has created divisions which have been exploited by the employers. Unions also engage in destructive sectarianism. It's sadly the case that unions often fail to recognise the common condition of the whole working class, and are only too willing to accept deals which benefit their own members at the expense of other workers. It's surely a disgrace to the whole trade union movement that members of the EEPTU should agree to work for Murdoch in Wapping, while other trade unions are being sacked, put out on the streets without any compensation at all. Do the electricians really believe that the next time Murdoch wants to introduce new technology, that in reward for setting their fellow workers down the river, that he will hold back from sacking them in the same way as he sacked the printers. But perhaps most damaging of all, unions have allowed a paid professional leadership to collude with the government and the capitalist class in the exploitation of the members who they claim to represent. How can trade union leaders continue to have credibility when they sit on government committees, on the boards of nationalised industries, and finally retire to the House of Lords? So what can trade unionists, individuals within trade unions, do to change society in the face of these limitations? For any trade union member who seriously wants to change society, who recognises that capitalism cannot be made to work in the interests of the working class, who is committed to working to bring about socialism, then I want to suggest a number of different strategies that he or she could adopt to hasten that process. Firstly, we must recognise that trade unions, while they're necessary to protect workers' interests within capitalism, are limited in what they can hope to achieve, since they're essentially defensive organisations. They should try to disabuse other trade unionists of the idea that it's possible to get a fair day's pay for a fair day's work. There's nothing fair about the capitalist system at all. Nor is there any possibility of achieving social justice in a system which operates on the basis of robbing the working class of the fruits of its labour. Secondly, we must recognise the importance of solidarity both within trade unions and between trade unions. The greatest strength of the working class is its solidarity, and our greatest weakness is disunity. And for that reason, anyone who's serious about wanting to get socialism cannot give support to trade union action which is designed to divide the working class rather than to unite it. So, following from that, I argue that we must reject any form of sectarianism and have no part in trade union action which seeks to better the position of our own trade union membership at the expense of other workers. The interests of the working class are simply not served by this kind of short-sighted, divisive action. And for the same reason, we must absolutely reject appeals to nationalism. It's of no concern whatsoever to workers whether Westland Helicopters or British Leyland are owned by British capitalists, American capitalists, or European capitalists. I was frankly appalled yesterday to see on the news workers standing outside the Westland shareholders' meeting encouraging their bosses to vote one way or the other. It makes no difference to their position whether or not the Sikorsky bid succeeded rather than the European consortium or the Russians or Colonel Gaddafi or anybody else.
Or Donald Duck.
Or Donald Duck. Whatever the nationality of the bosses, we will still be wage slaves and they will still run the industry according to the laws of capitalism. Thirdly, we must support any attempt to democratise trade unions. We must take back control of trade unions from the leadership. Although it's of no business to the government how trade unions conduct their internal affairs, and although I deplore the fact that the present Tory government is making political capital out of legislation which they claim is designed to increase trade union democracy, but which is in fact another part of their wholesale attack on the trade union movement, I also deplore the fact that the government was able to find undemocratic practices within trade unions and to exploit them for their own ends. Unions are only as strong as their members. We can take back power from the leadership. Most unions do, in fact, have democratic constitutions, but it's up to us as trade union members, as individuals within trade unions, to see that those constitutions are upheld and acted upon. We must insist that there's not only a ballot before a strike is called, but that there's also a ballot of the membership before any settlement of a dispute is agreed. Internal trade union democracy can only increase the strength of the unions and therefore of the working class as a whole. I don't think anybody here can fail to recognise that the position of the NUM during the miners' strike was seriously weakened by their refusal, by the refusal of the leadership to hold a ballot of the whole membership. And the consequences we're seeing now, a divided, weakened mine workers' union. We must also beware of trade unions becoming involved in the running and administration of capitalism. Workers have no place on boards of directors. Industrial democracy may sound all very well, but in fact it means that we will be forced to collude in our own exploitation. Sooner or later, a worker sitting on a board of directors of a company is, when faced with economic recession or falling markets or whatever, is going to have to decide which of his fellow workers is going to be made redundant. It's of no concern to workers the way in which boards of directors run companies. The most powerful weapon that trade unions have is the power to withdraw their labour, to go on strike. And again, we cannot permit ourselves to be disarmed by trade union leaders who enter into no strike agreements with the bosses. To allow trade union leaders to negotiate such agreements with the bosses will mean that we're well on the way to having bosses' unions, where trade union leaders, in return for recognition, undertake to deliver a disciplined workforce to our economic masters. And finally, we must press our trade unions to disaffiliate from the Labour Party. The Labour Party is a party that's committed to the running of capitalism, and the history of Labour in government proves that it's absolutely no friend of the working class, that it will not hesitate to enact the same kind of anti-working class, anti-trade union measures as any of the other capitalist political parties. It's quite simply absurd for trade unions to continue to contribute funds to the Labour Party to the tune of 75% of Labour Party funds, to enable them to take political power and then proceed to administer the very system which is the cause of working class exploitation. Support for the Labour Party means support for capitalism. Trade unions are limited in what they can hope to achieve within capitalism. But as individuals within trade unions, we must not only be aware of those limitations, but we must tell our fellow workers. But as a working class, politically conscious, united, and democratically organised, there are no limits on what we could achieve. The working class can change society, and trade unionists can contribute significantly to bringing about that change by actively working for socialism.